2014. I am Steve Dorff, the webmaster of www.gerweck.net, Gerweck.net, your source on the World Wide Web for all your pro wrestling news. It's a special day here at the Gerweck Report podcast. We have a special guest waiting, but up front, I want to wish my longtime tag team partner, Frank D, a happy birthday. I hope everything's going real well for you today, Frank.
Thank you very much, Steve, and it is so far. You know, I've gotten like a lot of people saying happy birthday to me since like 12 a.m. this morning. So everything's going good. I'm glad that, you know, by the grace of God, I woke up to actually see my 31st birthday. So it's all copacetic, man. Thank you very much.
And today we're going to talk a lot about WCW, which is Frank's probably his favorite topic overall in professional wrestling, other than maybe NWO, to be specific. And today to help us out to do that, and we really appreciate his time, a former WCW manager, mixed martial artist, Sonny Ono. How you doing today, Sonny?
Great. You know, first thing I want to do is wish Frank, a young man of 31, right?
Right.
Young man, a birthday. Well, he had informed me earlier that how old I was by telling me that he was 12 years old when he was a big fan of mine. So he's already got one strike against him, but I think he'll be all right. But a happy birthday, Frank.
Thank you very much, Sonny. I appreciate it.
And, thanks for having me. But you know what? I really want to ask you guys to do me a favor, because you guys are out there. You know, I just want to be introduced as innovator of selfie, Sonny Ono.
The innovator of selfie, Sonny Ono.
That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you started the selfie before selfies were popular.
Yeah, ultimately, you're out there with the
Ultimate Dragon. Before there was a lot of good camera on the phone. Absolutely.
So yes, you trademark that.
If you go on a lot of those old tapes and DVDs and stuff, you'll see me doing selfie with every entrance with all the people that I got the privilege to manage.
That's very true. I remember that. You coming out on Nitro with the Ultimate Dragon and the pyro going off in the background.
I just want to make sure that I get credit for it. There's no residual here, but, you know, I was ahead of my time once again.
Yeah, that's true.
I was doing mixed martial arts before the mixed martial art was cool or getting paid. So, So back in days. But anyway, ahead of my time.
Well Sonny, it's been a while since we've seen you in the American television scene. Can you kind of update us on what's going on with Sonny Ono these days and what you're doing outside of the business?
Well, I was fortunate enough last couple of weeks. I got to do a show in North Carolina. I was invited to do a show there and got to see a lot of my old friends like Buff Bagwell. And prior to that, Ernest Cat Miller and Eric Bischoff and Jeff Jarrett and many of the WCW and WWE superstars. I was with them doing autograph signing of Legend of Wrestling in New Jersey a couple weeks ago. So, you know, I think there's a lot to be said about our likeness is back on television, on Nitro show on the WWE channel. There's some interest and there's new eyeballs get to look at us again and enjoy what we did back in the heyday of wrestling.
You know, a lot of people remember you as the manager in WCW, but I don't think a lot of people really understand or appreciate your background in mixed martial arts. And can you talk about your MMA career and then ultimately meeting Eric Bischoff and getting to WCW?
Yeah, back in mid-70s, this really make you feel young, Frank. But mid-70s, Eric Bischoff worked up in one of the martial art karate school up in Minneapolis. And I'm about 2 hours south in Iowa. And we used to travel going to karate tournament on the weekends. And we used to share rides and travel together, kind of like what we did, you know, at wrestling. It's very similar. Except we weren't getting paid. You know, we would pay out $25 just so we can go out and beat people up, especially Eric. You know, he was a pretty good fighter. I think he fought around 150, 160 pounds. And he was a middleweight fighter. And, he would go on to fight, and I would compete as super lightweight, and we traveled the circuit, and that's how we got to be friends. And then I got involved into kickboxing from 1975 to 1981. I was number one bantamweight in the world. Saw some people that only lost to me, a guy named by Felipe Garcia, who ultimately became a world champion at a couple of different weight classes. Fought him. I think I fought him in Denver. And I think they didn't tell me about it at the time, but he was 16 and old boxer. And I'm thinking, you know, back in days, there wasn't a lot of regulation going on. So I said, this guy don't have any fights. It's his first kickboxing fight. I said, okay, this is great. And I was probably only went to like 3-0. But turned out that he was like a 16-0 professional boxer. But I won that fight. And he later became a world champion. And I think only loss he had was to me. And I think
wow.
He ended his career around 46-1. I mean that's my story of my kickboxing career. But so I got to do that, and you know, this is before martial art kickboxing was cool. So and certainly we weren't making any money. We were doing it because we like it. You know, once again I was ahead of the time. And that's how I got to know Eric. Once Eric and I had done some business together, we created a game called the Little Ninja Star War game, that's what the game was called. And Eric pitched that idea to a television station up there, and they referred him to AWA Wrestling, where they had a commercial time that they could buy. And because of that connection, they hired Eric to be an announcer for AWA.
Oh, wow.
And Eric will tell you that's how he got into the wrestling business. So we go back long ways. And there's a lot of little... I can't say I had a direct result to, you know, any of the Eric Bischoff success, but I did play a connection into him getting into wrestling business because of the project we did together. Once he moved on to a Turner, he called me and said, "Hey, I'm trying to do some business with Japanese guys, and do you want to go to Japan with me?" And you know, that's how I got to start working for World Championship Wrestling.
Wow, and that was around, you came in there around, was it 94 or 95 when you came into WCW?
Yeah, it was, I think it was summer or the spring of 90. Four is when we went to Japan.
Okay.
I can tell you, not knowing anything about wrestling business, me and Eric sitting in front of, you know, scariest Japanese-looking guys, Masa Saito, Sakaguchi, Choshu, you know, and they all look like they want to kill us. I mean, they're looking at us like, why are you here? And as Eric is translating... Well, as Eric speak and I'm translating for him, realizing that we kind of screwed those guys over, or at least the company did, and not produce what they agreed to. That's why they were mad at us. And you know, when I say us, not us as an individual, but at the company. And yeah. Eric made it so that we can rekindle their business together.
So you're referring to something that happened years prior before Eric took over?
Yeah, I think Bill Watts was the president at the time, or the people who was in charge, and they made a deal with him, and it was a talent exchange program that didn't, you know, in their mind certainly, and I'm not saying who's right or wrong or indifferent. I'm just saying that in their mind that we didn't send him the talent that we promised him, and it had a lot to do with communication, timing, and stuff like that. One of the Masa Saito asked, towards the end of the meeting, Masa Saito asked Eric, "Who is going to be our contact person?" And Eric, without skipping a beat, said, "Oh, that would be Sonny." And I said, I looked at him like, "I don't work for you." and so right after that, I looked at Eric and he goes, "Well, you work for me now." So that's kind of, you know, I was fortunate a timing. A lot of things plays, you know, why you get what you get or things happen to you. But I was very fortunate, and I will be forever grateful for, you know, my friendship, my continued friendship with Eric, and certainly what he gave me the opportunity for me to explore. And, you know, we got to do amazing thing together. He, you know, we got to go to a place like North Korea, for God's sake.
Right, to listen to Korea, pay-per-view.
Yeah, and imagine Eric Bischoff running in the street of Pyongyang with his shorts on at 8 o'clock in the morning running down the street. Only American, and mind you, before, you know, any of these people have probably never seen American, and, you know, he didn't take his Secret Service people with him, so they were kind of ticked off at him because he took off running. And any other American who'd been there before us either been shot down or captured.
Wow.
So it was kind of, you know, it was kind of, but looking back, what an opportunity. I'm walking, we went to visit one of the Kidozan, which is a very famous Japanese wrestler who happened to be a Korean. And there's a big tomb. They're a big fan of professional wrestling in North Korea, by the way. They have 24 television channel that was going on while we were there, nothing but wrestling. And other channel was nothing but propaganda, you know. So it was really interesting times and opportunity. I remember Deborah Wong from ABC came up to us and said, how did you guys get to come here? I've been trying to get here for 5 years. And Mike Chinoy, who was a CNN head reporter, he was the only person who was allowed to, any foreign correspondent had been allowed to come there. And so they were kind of tickled to death because, you know, their take on professional wrestling is kind of tongue-in-cheek, and they can't believe that you know, that we got to come because of professional wrestling.
American TV is pretty much propaganda anyway, so kind of fitting, right?
but it is pretty amazing. I mean, obviously, you know, we weren't there. We don't know how World War II went down, but, you know, pretty much everybody kind of understand what really, you know, we know who won, who lost. And I remember being interviewed. Eric and I were kind of isolated, and they had a reporter was trying to get some footage from us, certainly saying something negative about our country. But he, you know, they would ask Eric, you know, there was 4,000 45,000 bombs that was dropped in Pyongyang. That's equal to every citizen, one bomb for each citizen, or something like that. And, you know, don't you think America should be responsible for that? And they would ask Eric a question like that, and Eric would go, I wasn't there. I wasn't born then. I don't, you know, and those are basically the answer we gave.
Yeah.
You know, but they have a little distorted a view of how the war went down. You know, obviously, you know, American and Japanese were enemies at the time, and their version is the evil American had nothing to do with defeating Japanese. It was North Korea who defeated Japanese. And I said, really? I didn't know that. You know, so it was you know, of course, you don't argue with them, but you know, it was interesting, but it was a great time. I mean, for me, great time in the sense that I got the experience where a lot of people don't get the experience. Coming back from the Kidozan's graveyard, I'm going back to the car, and I got somebody, you know, kind of brushing my hair behind me. So I turn around and look, and it's Muhammad Ali punching back in my head.
Wow.
Throwing jabs at me. And so I mean, Eric actually snapped a picture of me and Muhammad Ali squaring off in a parking lot. And you know what? I mean, he's one of my heroes. So, and he signed, and I got a watch from him. That he signed it to Sonny Muhammad Ali, or a watch of him standing over a face of watch to him standing over Sonny Liston. You know, that famous picture. So, like I said, I am forever grateful for the opportunity that was given to me. And honestly, I know Eric has his, you know, he's when you're president of a company and when you're dealing with, you know, wrestlers, and of course they want what they want, and when you're president of the company, you gotta you know, do what you got to do to make the best product possible. And I'm sure there's people out there that, you know, don't like Eric. But I will tell you this much, and I don't think anybody can really argue with me, and I said this on another show, that because of success of WCW during that period, a lot of wrestlers got to be a millionaires.
That's right. And
prior to that, there was no competition, per se. They weren't people getting paid. Wrestler wasn't getting paid the big money. And like or hate him, you got to thank Eric for that.
I can tell you something. I will say I'm a huge Eric Bischoff fan, and I do realize that, you know, Bischoff did a lot of things. He did some things wrong in the business, but he did a lot of things right. If it wasn't for Eric Bischoff, you know, and Ted Turner starting up Monday Night Raw on TNT, wrestling would never have gotten as hot as it did in that time period. You know, like you said, wrestlers never would have gotten paid. I mean, the NWO angle, you know, and Hall and Nash jumping over to WCW and Hulk Hogan turning heel and the Cruiserweight division and everything you guys were doing down there at the time in WCW is what really set the world and set the business on fire. And Eric Bischoff, if it wasn't for Bischoff, there would be no guaranteed contracts in wrestling today. So you're very much correct on the money on that.
I agree with you 100%. I mean, I don't think, obviously, when you're in that position, and you also got to remember, and I'm not knowing all the details, his hand, it wasn't like it was his company. He didn't get to do what he wanted to do all the time.
Right.
I think there was people that didn't want to do Thunder and producing all those television hours of, you know, hours and hours of television show. And obviously, when you give away that much television, free television, it's going to suffer the pay-per-view to a certain degree. So, you know, there was a lot of stuff that I'm sure, in retrospect, if you could have done it again, and all of us in our lifetime, you know, we'd do things different. But the point I'm trying to make is that he is, I'm not saying this because he's my friend, and he's, you know, with my experience with him, but he has given so many people such a great opportunities. And put a lot of money in a lot of those guys' pocket. You know, because of the talent that we needed, we got to bring a lot of those superstars from Japan. And taking that NWO angle back to Japan, New Japan Pro Wrestling made an amazing amount of money during that period of time. Summer of 1998, I believe, we sold $5 million worth of black and white NWO t-shirt in Japan.
Wow.
That's a lot of t-shirt.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Masa Chono just recently, I guess he worked out a deal with WWE to start selling the NWO t-shirt in Japan again.
Yeah, he has a little fashion clothesline that he has, and I think unfortunately for Chono, who didn't make any money on any of those t-shirts, so it's a chance for him to make that money back.
Wow.
So he didn't get the make back in days. You know, it's interesting. I learned a lot about business, how business was done before that I was there. They thought I was making some money off those t-shirts. Matter of public record, I did not make any money off any t-shirt that was sold in Japan. I wish I did. But, you know, it's interesting that Dean Malenko, Chris Jericho, and I'm not sure about Chris was with New Japan at the time, but you take Benoit, you take Eddie Guerrero. Those guys were all on the contract with New Japan at the time. And second years of our relationship with New Japan, Eric put them under our contract at WCW and allowed them to go back to Japan. And, you know, so we expanded our talent relationship program. And that's when they came here. And, you know, and look what those guys did. And Cruiserweight were phenomenal. Then you take somebody like Ultimo Dragon, you know, Kanemoto, Jushin Thunder Liger. You know, you got that was a wrestling, amazing wrestling that we gave him on a television show. Yes, there was Stings and Hogan's and Pipers and all those people that was at the top. There was, you know, a lot of storyline, a lot of intrigues and all that stuff. But if you look at the wrestling we gave was phenomenal. Those guys did, and even some of the girls we brought over from Japan. Buonatano to Medusa that we signed here. Because Medusa really couldn't work. It was really very limited number of Americans that could wrestle that style with Japanese. And Medusa had worked there with All Japan Pro Wrestling. So once Medusa was on board, we could bring people like Akira Hokuto, you know, Buonatano, and even Chigusa Nagaya was here for a little bit. So, and I'm a big fan of women wrestling, so, and from Japan. They're phenomenal athletes.
Is there a reason, you know, when you go back to your career in the WCW, you know, you talk about the relationship you guys have with New Japan Pro Wrestling. In 1995, a lot of those talents came over, like, you know, Hiroshi Tenzan, Kintsuki Sasaki. These guys came over, and you guys had the World Cup series at Starrcade 95.
Yeah.
How did that transition over to first time that you were actually on WCW TV? You were just a referee doing a karate match between Hacksaw Jim Duggan and me.
Actually, the first time I was on television in WCW was I was one of the commissioner, international commissioner member to reinstate Ric Flair.
That's right, you were, and then you came on as that referee of that match.
Yeah, I did a match with Ming. I was a referee, martial art. It was a mixed martial art match.
And then how did you transition over from being that, you know, being a referee into being the heel manager, Sonny Ono, and you're coming over with New Japan, and you had an angle going on, I remember, with Bobby Heenan, where...
Yeah, well, the storyline was, you know, what was real fun was on a Saturday, it was really, really interesting. You could develop a storyline on a Saturday TV taping.
Right.
And if they liked it, they would take it to Monday Night Nitro or Thunder Show, and that was the premises, was that, you know, I was a rich Japanese businessman. And you got to remember, this is current event at the time where Japanese yen is really strong, dollars weak. So, you know, they were over here. The Japanese in general was buying a lot of companies and golf courses and everything else over here. So, you know, we just kind of played along on that storyline. And one of the funniest time I ever had was Colonel Parker trying to sell me a Mount Rushmore. And we were taping there. And actual tourist people were really getting mad at me. You can't buy that. Yes, I can. My face would look really good next to Washington.
Oh, wow. I can only imagine.
And so, you know, we got to do a lot of fun thing on Saturday TV taping. But what really got me into, to answer your question, was that because of international flavor that we were given that they weren't doing, meaning WWE, we needed these Japanese guys to do some interviews, and thus none of them spoke English. So, you know, I got to play that part and if you really dig really deep, if you really want to dig deep, when we were coming back from Japan, Eric and I have a conversation and saying, you know, it's too bad that company and company can't compete against each other like the World Cup. I remember having this conversation there. And thus came New Japan coming into WCW, challenging WCW talent.
Right.
And that was kind of prelude to NWO angle. Because here's prelude was another company coming in to take over. And that was a prelude to that. If you connect the dot, that's what those ideas kind of came from, I think.
Right, because the NWO angle, you know, like you said, originally, you know, started in New Japan, correct? It was the...
Well, something similar. It was company versus company kind of thing, yeah.
Right, you know, promotional kind of...
And you know what, and they're doing it again. You know that. They're over there, they got... New Japan is doing something similar to that now. You know, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Hey, Sonny, did they ever have an exit strategy for the NWO? I think that's one of the common complaints about WCW over the years. It was a hot angle, and it definitely took over television, and it grew by leaps and bounds, and then they kind of watered it down to different factions. did you ever hear of an exit strategy, or was that
no,
just
you know,
kind
I
of...
was not. Yeah, I wasn't involved in any of that booking kind of thing. You know, I was trying to get my, making sure that my Japanese and Mexican talent can get to the building, and you know, I was not involved in any of the writing stuff or anything like that. So I wouldn't have any idea. I know for a fact that we would go to the building, and they would have so many talent there because a lot of stuff wouldn't get finalized who's going to be on television until you know, 10 minutes before the show.
You know, another criticism they had, looking back at the Nitro years, was it was a great product. It was something different, you know, something different than Monday Night Raw. But you'd have the luchadors out there stealing the show, the Psicosis, the Hoovy, Super Calo, La Parca, etc., Ultimo Dragon. And yet, that wasn't really the focal point of the show. They'd be out there busting their butts in the ring, and you'd have the announcers talking about what's coming up in the main event or what's coming up with the latest developments of NWO. What was your opinion of that? Because it seemed like these guys were busting their butts, and they really weren't getting the attention they deserved.
You know, what can you say? I mean, Mike Tenay did a great job. We used to call him Professor because, you know, he knew everything about it. He would study about the talent, and he would try to get him over. But, yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate. You know, as far as talent goes, I think those guys are great, amazing talent. And once they got kind of hybrid into the American style / Mexican style / stiff Japanese style, that's why I think Ultimo Dragon, a guy like him, is so over all over. Because, you know, he can work Mexico and Japan and the United States and still... You know, he's a hybrid. I mean, he can work any styles, any place. And I think that's one of the reasons a guy like Chris Jericho does really well. You know, he worked in Japan, worked in Mexico, and certainly he's very charismatic. I think that's why he's one of the top talent over there even today.
When you were on an episode of Nitro, I remember you were managing Masahiro Chono. And I guess Chono at the time was... the storyline was he was getting recruited by the NWO. And one night on Nitro, he turned on you and had the NWO t-shirt on. You were trying to, you know, Mean Gene was asking you what he was saying, and you were trying to come up with something. And then a couple weeks later, you brought out the Great Muta.
You know, those are the things that we got to do that I had a little play in it because they wanted to expand, obviously, for business reasons. They wanted to have NWO faction, you know, NWO version of Japan, and Chono was perfect for it. And two of the top stars, Chono and Muta, becoming NWO, going back to New Japan. And since they already knew, I mean, in turn, you know, Chono and Muta is like Scott and Nash that was here, going back to Japan and doing their version of it. And so I was a recipient of all that nest but, you know, I got to play a part in probably, and I'm guessing, and I'm probably right, best years of New Japan Pro Wrestling financial-wise. Because when they took that NWO Japan back to, I mean, it was so big that people who were not interested in wrestling, professional wrestling, was buying a ticket, coming into the arena, buying like 10 t-shirts and leaving, not watching any wrestling. I mean, it really became to have an NWO logo was it became bigger than wrestling in Japan at the time. Kind of like it was here. It got bigger than wrestling. There was people wearing NWO t-shirt and they didn't know what it was for. And I, like I said, looking back, I'm just tickled to death that I got to play a part in height of probably most profitable, most watched time in professional wrestling.
Well, that's a good, you know, segue into my next question for you. What do you think, in your evaluation of it, is wrong today with the wrestling business?
Well, it's a difficult job, I think, to keep things fresh. How do you develop new talent? There's only so many big top talents, and to develop new guys, I think it's tough. You know, from injuries perspective to, you know, just the grind on the road. Like, it's a very difficult. I don't think most fans doesn't realize those guys on the road 300 some days a year. I think you know, not sleeping in your own bed and trying to have a family back home and all that stuff is very, very difficult. And it's very taxing for a lot of those athletes. And they do pay a price. You know, their work hurt, you know, so they're on the medication, right or wrong or indifferent. I mean, think about it. If you're an athlete that your dream is to become a professional wrestler and you get signed by a big company or one of the main companies and you get to be on television. So, Frank, you and I are an angle. They're actually going to give us a spot on television to give us a little angle. I get hurt on one of the house shows. So what happens then? I kill not only my future, but I'm killing your future. So a lot of times those guys will work hurt, and it's a double-edged sword because and they pay a price for that success. I'm not saying that happens all the time, but it happens a lot. So I think that's a hard choice those guys have to make. And you and I know some of those guys might get just one chance. And God, so I think it's a very difficult job.
Can you talk a little bit about the politics in WCW? Obviously, there was factions in WCW, the power structure there. And we also would hear a lot about you get to a taping and they'd have a board set up. And then by the end of the evening, you know, prior to the show going live, the board would change and hear about people not sure 30 minutes before the show who they're working, what the angle's going to be. Can you kind of speak to that? Were you kind of a part of that as well?
You know, I mean, I've been there. There will be a board that will be up there, and they would have so many talent there because everybody had to show up, you know, and we had to be at the arena by noon. But finding out who's going to be on the show, who's not going to be on the show, and obviously we were, in many cases, when Chono and Muda and those guys are here, I know we were going to be in a show because they're only here for, you know, a very short time. They're not a permanent talent, but like Yuji, and I would tell Yuji, I said, Yuji, I mean, he was here as a great company guy from New Japan. Our job was to, you know, make him a star here so he can go back and become a bigger star in Japan, and I think we did that. Even to this day, you know, he's still competing, and he's still very, very important part of New Japan Pro Wrestling. We stay in touch. He does, but I would tell Yuji, I said, Yuji, we need to go. You're not on the show. We're not on the show. And Yuji would go, no, Sunny-san, we'll stay. And sure enough, you know, after hour one, Terry Taylor would come running into the locker room, look around the room, because once, you know, your name was on the board, a lot of people left because, you know, they don't want to be doing the jobs because, you know, you're not going over. So,
right.
But Yuji would stay, and you know, and towards the end of his tenure with WCW, but he was a great company man. He said he didn't care. He just wanted to, you know, if he went out there, that didn't bother him. He just wanted to be out there. So he would stay, and you know, sure enough, he would come in, and Booker would go, Yuji, you know, 10 minutes, you're up. So he's just a great guy. You know, most of the guy would have left with everybody else. But that's, you know, so but far to answer your question about the politics of it, I think they just had a hard, you know, they would have a storyline that they would write once we got to the building, but a lot of things would get changed because of objection from the talent, and or not. I mean, I'm not saying that they got their ways. It's live TV. It's pretty amazing. It's amazing that they produce what they produce under the circumstances. And like I said, you know, I sound like a broken record player, but I'm just tickled that I was involved in that period of time.
Yeah, that's one of my main criticisms of Eric Bischoff was he was the guy in charge. And, you know, somebody's got to be the boss. Somebody's got to say, okay, we're doing it this way, we're doing it that way. And some of the contracts that he would structure by giving certain wrestlers creative control kind of limited what you could do. Raven could come in and say, I want this guy in my flock, I don't want this guy in my flock. Or somebody comes in and says, I want to work with this guy, I don't want to work with this guy. Or somebody comes in and says, well, I'll put him over, but I won't put him over. And that was part of one of my main criticisms of Eric Bischoff was he signed so many great talent, and then at the end of the day, you know, somebody's got to be the boss, and at times he let kind of things get out of control backstage.
Yeah, you know, I wasn't really, you know, involved in any of that stuff, but I will tell you this. Eric is not a pushover. I mean, you make it sound like he was a pushover. And one word I wouldn't use is, you know, he was pretty firm on a lot of things. And I'm at times, at right circumstances, I think you could get him to do something for you. But, you know, you have to make sense. And I, you know, like I said, I'm sure he would change things in retrospect. But, and I don't know what the contract was like or how it was written, you know, what he had to do to get people there. You know, Eric was interested in, you know, stuff that he was, you know, let's get this done today. We'll worry about that tomorrow. And that was a lot of his philosophy. And it worked for him pretty well. And I obviously he matured from that. And, you know, he's pretty successful at what he's doing now. Like I said, a lot of those things I don't, you know, I can only tell you my experience. And I wasn't involved in any of the booking or any of that stuff. So I couldn't tell you.
WCW started to decline really around late 1998, early 1999. And then Eric Bischoff was sent home by Harvey Schiller. And the creative change happened in WCW when WWE writers Vince Russo and Ed Ferrara came down to WCW. Sonny, can you talk about how that transition was from the Bischoff led administration to now you're dealing with a guy from the WWE?
You know, it's interesting. And like I said, the Russo probably have very selective memory of what went down during that period of time. You know, the man has never said I say hello to him once in Minneapolis. That was it. That's the only time I spoke to him. Honest truth. We never had a conversation. And all I know is that I just signed a 2-year deal 2 months prior to that. And he made a statement that it's not a public record about disparaging remarks of Mexicans and Japanese and the fact that they're not American and thus they're not going to be on an American television show. And he's the head writer. And next thing we know, all the Mexicans and all the Japanese is taken off television.
Wow.
So it is what it is. I mean, it's just a matter of history. That's what happened. The only people that actually stayed was Conan, who's not, you know, he's from Southern California, Mexican descent. So is Ray. And those are the only two guys that stayed. Everybody else, I take that back. Juventud stayed as well. I think he was the only luchador that actually stayed, if I'm right. And other than that, I think everybody was terminated.
How were you let go then? Who informed you and what did they tell you?
Well, JJ called me and told me that they were going to exercise their 90-day termination clause and offered to pay me in one lump sum. And I said, no, that's okay. I'm not signing anything. So I got paid for the next 90 days and you know, rest is history.
And then later you filed a lawsuit against WCW for discrimination, correct?
Yeah, it was pretty slam dunk, actually. I mean, like I said, you know, people make a mistake that it's like I was, you know, I might have been, or at least the perception was that there was a group of us filed a lawsuit. But that group was not a group lawsuit. It was every one of those lawsuits was separate. It just happened to be, you know, there was like half a dozen of them, or probably more like a dozen of them. You know, many of those were from African Americans. Somehow, but you got to remember, I wasn't a wrestler. I was somebody who worked in an office, as well as, my office was, job was limited in the sense that I was international consultant. It was my title, and then I was helping the obviously Japanese guys and facilitating those businesses. As well as, taking care of their talent when they were here. But, you know, that's a misconception that people had that it was some kind of class action lawsuit. It wasn't. And because my lawsuit was a little bit different than others, so it wasn't about me. I knew the stuff that went on in, you know, the stuff that was in the office itself, what was being said, who said it. In my case, that's probably why that they perceived that my case had a little bit key to it than a lot of other guys. And mind you, I didn't file the lawsuit when Eric was there. I filed a lawsuit when Eric was gone.
And from what I understand, you got a nice settlement out of the deal.
Then that's, you know, I mean, it's one of those things that they made it right. So, and you know, it, more than anything else, and I said this in other interviews, that it, retrospect, it worked out okay, in a sense that I got to spend, you know, my oldest daughter, who played soccer, and so I got to do more of a father thing, and I have three other younger, so I have four kids altogether, and I got to see them go through high schools and then college, and become successful. So I am, you know, in retrospect, I got to spend time with them. So, and you know how it is when you're doing it, you don't realize what you're missing. You know, I got to experience my family life, and got to embrace that. So, you know, it worked out really well.
What was your reaction when Vince McMahon bought WCW?
I knew that a lot of the boys was going to suffer, because when you eliminate a competition, they have all the leverage. It's like playing a World Series with one team. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's just like, yep. Yeah, so I knew at the end of the day, the boys was going to suffer. You know, a lot of guys, I think, got their contract renewed in a sense that it's got, you know, cut down a lot. You know, you can't blame the company either. I mean, they spent money to buy it, so they eliminate the competition. You know, if there's only one place you can go buy groceries, they can ask whatever they want, and they can pay you for whatever you want to restock their shelves. I know there was a lot of boys that was happy about what happened, but I don't think they were looking at the big picture. Big picture was, you got one place to work in retrospect. That, or, you know, you go to Japan. But so I think they weren't looking at the big picture. If they would look at the big picture, the best time of their life, financial life, was when there was two companies that was doing well. The fighting for the talent and everything else. Fighting for the rating, fighting for the talent. That gives the boys the leverage. And once that other company got bought out by WWE, then why should they? You know, it's what market bears. It's like going to an auction with one guy standing buying the cars.
Right. That's right. You know, Sonny, reflecting on your WCW stint, what would you say is kind of the highlight moment of being there?
As a talent or as...
Yeah, from a talent perspective. What was like the favorite night, you know, being part of WCW, or the favorite angle or story? Or
I think most exposure I got was what we talked about earlier, when Chono turned on me and I bring Muda to avenge my disgrace, and Muda turns on me. And that's become the biggest and probably angle in Japan, the NWO Japan angle, you know, and I got a big exposure in Japan for obvious reasons, and got a pretty good pop here as far as rating goes. But I will tell you that one of the fun time I ever had, aside from, you know, all the traveling I mentioned earlier, got to do the things with going to North Korea and meeting Muhammad Ali, and got those kind of opportunities with Antonio Inoki and such. But I enjoyed working with Hokuto and Bo Nakano, and obviously Medusa, because I am just amazed by their talent. You know, they don't get enough credit. I say this all the time on every interview, but go look at some of those girls' matches on YouTube. Of Maeda, you know, Bo Nakano, Chigusa Nagayo, Kaoru. Those, I mean, you watch those matches and you go, holy fuck it.
That's right.
I mean, really, you look at the wrestling now, and you look at that tape, and you tell me, I don't think they got enough credit for it, for their work ethics and what they went through to get there. But to answer your question, probably those are the two spots. I think one of the fun time we had, one of the scariest and fun time we had, was when I had Bo Nakano versus Medusa at Sturgis, the bike versus bike match, where I took a sledgehammer to Medusa's bike, and I thought I was going to get shot there. But they weren't wrestling fans. They were bikers.
You know, Sonny, another guy I always thought that never really got the accolades he deserves for the talent that he showed on television was Ernest the Camp Miller.
Yeah.
Never got the respect. Great character, great presence, great catchphrases, and went to WWE and just never really went anywhere.
Yeah,
but a great talent overall.
Yeah, I think that had a lot to do with there's a certain amount of I don't know for a fact, obviously. It's just my observation. It's just that since he was not came up the line of wrestling school, wrestling, paying his dues and that kind of thing, I think he suffered a little bit from Eric's, because he was actually Eric Bischoff's son, Garrett Bischoff's karate instructor. And he's a legit, three-time world champion. And because of his relationship to Eric, he probably got, some of the people may not like that. I think, because I suffer from it to a certain degree, at least my perception is. It's a double-edged sword when you're a friend with the boss. Sometimes it's probably not good to be a boss's friend, but, as far as from what other people's perceptions are. But certainly, I could care less what others were thinking. But I think Ernest probably suffers that as well. One of the things that it's really interesting, that one of the things that Russo said in his defense, he says, I separated Sonny from Ernest because Ernest didn't need a mouthpiece. And if he would have watched the show, I was never Ernest's mouthpiece. I never spoke for him. I was his sidekick. I was the reason, what other part of the manager does. I was the reason why, I screw up, that's Ernest lost. That kind of thing. But I took, if he would have watched the show prior to coming over, he would have probably known that. But, that's...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that would have been helpful.
Yeah, it would have been helpful. But that was his, I remember that's his defense that he throws out there all the time. Says, you didn't need a mouthpiece. Well, I was never his mouthpiece. Yes, Ernest does not need a mouthpiece. He didn't need it. But, funny thing was, after, I disappeared from television, Ernest had a valet. Mrs. Jones, remember?
Yeah, Mrs. Jones, yeah.
So, for the guy who says he doesn't need someone to be next to him, then what was Mrs. Jones' part? I mean, if you can go back, not that I really care, but
stating the facts.
Yeah, stating the fact that his statement doesn't make sense.
I thought you guys were a very entertaining duo. I remember Ernest would do the match. He worked the match. And then when the match was over, you'd come in the ring and bring him his robe, and he would bust out with the red shoes and do James Brown moves. That was very, very entertaining things. And
we had such a fun, like I said, Saturday night TV taping, we would get to do so much thing. One of the fun time, you asked me, one of the fun time we had, and it would have been a great angle if we could have kept doing it. But Saturday night, Ernest had a match with Prince Ikea, and I can't sing a lick. What we did was, we would get in the ring, and I go, I got a great match for you today. I didn't say a match. I got a great surprise for you today. You know what we have tonight? We have Prince. Prince. And he go, Prince? Yeah, Purple Rain, Prince. And Ernest and I would sing a duet of Purple Rain. And real bad version of that. And then, of course, the music hits, and Prince Ikea would come on, and he would have a match, Then next week, we had a guy named Al Green, who was a pretty good talent. Didn't get an opportunity to really get over. And so next week I would come on and say, hey, sorry about the confusion last week. Translation, Japanese thing. I'm sorry, Ernest. But today I have Al Green, the preacher, the Let's Get Together. And we would sing Let's Get Together, a real bad version of that. And, of course, Al Green would come out, and we'd do that. And we wanted to keep doing that so that I would make a mistake of, you know, some of the talent that we have. Those are the things we got to do on Saturday night. And Jimmy Hart, God bless him, he was in charge of a lot of those Saturday night tape that we would come to him with idea, and he would just let us do it, because all the other guys were so busy, you know, doing the Nitro and Thunder. But those are times that, you know, that we had fun, got over, entertained the crowd. So those are the time I miss. And Ernest and I probably talked to each other every other day. Matter of fact, I was with him in a karate tournament 2 weeks ago in New York. Watched him compete and win a grand championship. And you know, he's getting old too. He's 50.
Wow.
But he can still keep the upside of your head. I mean, he's pretty tough still.
What does the future hold for Sonny Ono? Is there a chance we might see you with Jeff Jarrett's Global Force Wrestling?
Well, interesting you ask that question, because you know Jeff, a real kind person. I mean, I think he's a real good business person. He's got something going on that I think he'll be exciting. And since he says global, I hope he brings a lot of international talent. He's already doing a pay-per-view, I believe, out of Japan that they're going to broadcast here. And I don't know if that's a global event or a New Japan event. I would be happy. He was one of those kind persons, believe it or not. Back in 2000, when TNA was starting, of course, that was Jeff's idea and to get that company started, and he actually flew me to Vegas and offered me a job. And because under the circumstances, it didn't work out. But I'd be honored and be happy to work with, you know, and guy like Jeff and be able to help him and you know, either in limited capacity or whatever, you know. Those guys certainly know professional wrestling. I mean, you know, that's in their blood. So anything I can help them internationally, I would love to be able to be included and if I can be of assistance in any way, form or shape. But you know, my son, who, you know, I haven't been totally away from wrestling. My son been wrestling at high school. And he graduated last year and won a, you know, state of Iowa, is amateur wrestling is pretty big here. They sell out 20,000 seat arena in 5 minutes. It's bigger than anything else that you can imagine. High school wrestling in the state of Iowa is phenomenal. But he won a state at 126 at the biggest school class, which is 3A. You know, I'm a proud dad. I will shamelessly say that, he won state last year. Nobody took him down. He went undefeated, 47-0, and just helped his dad out. And he's got a little nice scholarship, and he's going to Wartburg College, which is a Division III NCAA, 11-time national champion. They're national champion last 4 years in a row. So, you know, hopefully he can make the lineup and contribute to that program, and I get to watch him wrestle.
That's a hell of an accomplishment.
And
awesome.
I do threaten.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I do threaten once in a while to wear my suit and go out there and hit the referee with a chair, but I don't think that'll go over. You'll probably make the news, but.
In a wrong type of way, though.
Yeah, that'll probably make a pretty good news on ABC. Deranged old professional wrestling father flips out and takes a chair to collegiate wrestling.
So real to me, damn it.
Right. But yeah, so you know, I'm proud of my boy, and you know, he's doing really well. And like I said, if you go to my Facebook, you can see, you know, my family there, and you know, I'm blessed. I am blessed with a lot of things. That I mean, I really can't be much happier unless I win a Powerball or something. But other than that, I think you know, I can't ask for much more. So my life is good, man.
Well, we definitely appreciate getting an opportunity to talk to you today, Sonny. And I know, you know, Frank's favorite topic to talk about is WCW, and today's his birthday, so I thought it'd be a kind of a great tie-in. We really enjoyed going down memory lane with the old Nitros and Thunders and the world class that we got a chance to see, worldwide tapings, and kind of reflect on, you know, when wrestling was really good, you know, back in the day. And so we definitely enjoyed talking to you today. And as we wrap with you, is there anything you'd like to plug, mention, appearances, social media, anything you want to or maybe talk about your the business that you're currently involved in.
Well, you know, we do a couple of friends of mine. We have a company called the Ronin Production. We do event coordinating. We do a lot of amateur athletic events, everything from, you know, wrestling. We do an event like a festival. We did one here last year in the town that I'm in Mason City, Iowa. You know, everything from dance competition to cheerleading competition to the powerlifting, wrestling, karate tournament. We have all weekend of festivals, from tennis at the archery, roller derby. We do all that, and we do those kind of festivals for the community. You know, we do one here, and we are, matter of fact, we are in negotiation and discussion with people down in the Atlanta area that we want to do one down there. So, you know, I get to do projects, and it's great. And, you know, and I also, I have always owned all these years, from the days of my martial art days, you know, I always owned a little car dealership. So I get to play around and have my Rolls Royce and my BMWs and my Porsches, and my wife can't complain to me because they're considered inventory.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
there's always more than one way to skin a cat. So, yeah, so, you know, my wife can't say, well, what do you do with all those cars? Well, I look at them, I polish them, I drive them once in a while. She said, well, why don't you sell them? I said, well, yeah, they're all for sale. They're all inventories.
Well, good stuff, Sonny. As I said, we've definitely enjoyed chatting with you today, and, you know, we wish you nothing but best of luck in the future.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate talking to you guys and allowing me to, you know, I'm always amazed that people are interested in anything I have to say. But I just want you to be out there. Whenever you mention my name, just be sure to tell everybody that I am the innovator of the selfie.
Absolutely. We'll definitely do that. Thanks again, Sonny.
All right. Thanks, guys.